Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We are so glad to be back on the air. We had a lot of thoughts and things that bothered us. And
rants. We had some rants.
Rants. And so we would basically just get a group of us together in the break room, and we would do a radio show. And we realized, well, if we're doing that, we might as well go ahead and record it. So we are back on the air with Health Matters, and we are here now until we take another long break and get tired of recording and start going back to the break room again. This is the We're Back, and It's Worse Than We Thought show. This is a chance to talk about things that are worse than we thought, and we've got a number of them, as it turns out. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, and a special radio wave to those fine, hardworking folks at the MSU Ronald G. Eglin Space Science Center. With me to absorb rants and also to deliver some of her own from the University of Kentucky Assistant Professor in the Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
Rick Phillips, of course, is in Isomville monitoring traffic patterns and also alert for any type of weather threats, so he will not be in today. So we will be mercifully brief with our website. It's wmky.org to listen to our show. You can click on the Health Matters link, or you could click on a better link and listen to something better. Also, we are still on Facebook, HM Radio Show on Facebook, and we will occasionally put things in there from the show. We will get back to that now that we're back on the air. Our sponsor, insect and arthropod repellents, because it is a jungle out there. According to the CDC, infections caused by mosquitoes, ticks, and fleas have increased by 300% in the past 12 years. What I'm saying is the ticks, the mosquitoes that you grew up with, the ones that were annoying, but let's face it, not really worth doing anything about, are no more. There are seven new tick-borne illnesses since 2004. We now have the invasive East Asian longhorn tick, which will soon be pretty much all over the East. Right now it's in New Jersey. These are ticks that swarm by the hundreds and can kill. And I don't think this is not like the fire ants. It's just that if you have livestock or if you happen to fall asleep in the barnyard yourself, you would wake up with not one, not two, but 100 or more ticks bit into you, and that's what's happened. They have found it on livestock. It is mainly a veterinary concern, but it does carry some diseases, particularly Ehrlichia, which is a febrile illness and also causes blood changes. Mosquitoes, of course, dengue fever, Zika virus, the chikungunya, the yellow fever, West Nile virus. All of these viruses basically, for the most part, make you feel like you've had the flu, but they all have that ability to cause an encephalitis, an inflammation of the brain tissue, which can be serious and even life-threatening. So we are urging our radio fans not simply to slap and pick and ignore these vectors, but rather to take up arms against them, I guess.
And take it seriously, because I've always had issues with mosquitoes, but I've never had problems with ticks ever, ever, ever. And I grew up playing outside, never had problems. This year, even taking precautions, I've had ticks for the first time this year.
So they are there. They are there in larger numbers, particularly now that we have these massive amounts of rainfall in the spring. They love the damp earth, and we have a lot of damp earth. Couple of things. First of all, be aware of peak exposure times and places. Arthropod bites can be reduced if you modify your pattern or location of activity. Mosquitoes can bite any time during the day, but the dengue, Zika, and chikungunya mosquitoes, the tiger mosquitoes, daylight hours, and the others, of course, more common at dusk. Ticks and chiggers found in grasses, woodlands, or vegetated areas. Let's face it, Shelley, if you spend most of your time on asphalt and concrete, you're probably going to be safe from tick bites, more or less.
Probably, yeah.
Wear appropriate clothing, and can we just say here in Kentucky, that is a rarity, wearing the appropriate clothing. But they mentioned long sleeve shirts, long pants, boots, and hats. Boy, that is a fun summer outfit. Tuck the shirt in. That you can at least do that. I mean, maybe you don't care to look presentable in the woods, but it is good to tuck your shirt in.
Tuck your pants into your socks.
That's what they recommend. I've struggled with that one. Stretch the tops of the socks out. You put a pair of blue jeans in a sock, and you've got a really big sock.
You do.
You are absolutely right. Check for ticks daily. Showering within 2 hours of being in a tick-infested or a chigger-infested area also reduces the risk of disease. They mentioned something called spatial repellents. These are the yard foggers. We have no idea how well they work. They work in laboratory conditions well enough that they are being sold. But in terms of what happens in your yard on a windy day, whether it is an enclosed area, whether it's an open area, that's pretty much up for grabs. And you can imagine a spatial repeller has a varying degree of effectiveness depending on the size, the air currents, and the openness of the place you're trying to fog. A couple of things. I'll stop at this point reminding you on skin, DEET is your number one product. On clothing, permethrin is your number one product. We'll talk more about that in our next fractional portion, but remember those two products. That's our sponsor, insect and arthropod repellents. It's a jungle out there. Now, my first rant is about earthquakes.
Earthquakes. What have earthquakes done to you?
They are a major health threat. Well, they have annoyed me, which is what most things do anymore. As you might know, Ridgecrest, California, 7.1 magnitude earthquake following up a 6.4 tremor. They call it a pre-shock, and then you got the 7.1 earthquake, leaving cracks visible from satellites in the Southern California desert area. That's 150 miles northeast of Los Angeles in Ridgecrest. Here's my problem. When we first saw the video footage of the earthquake, they cut. Of course, the swimming pools rocked. The chandeliers went back and forth. And then they cut to a liquor store where bottles were falling off the shelves and breaking.
Okay.
You open a liquor store on a fault line. Let me remind you. You open a liquor store on a fault line, and you put your bottles on a flat shelf. What did you think would happen?
I don't know. I would like to know what the insurance people thought about that.
Well, I mean, every time there's a tornado, you have to have somebody, generally a person who's not that loquacious, describe it as it sounds like a freight train.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is every time there's an earthquake, they cut to the liquor store. And so I'm thinking, and this is an opportunity in our Health Matters, I want a crowdfunding for this thing. We're going to make liquor shelves that are earthquake-proof. If you can put a skyscraper on shock absorbers so that it sways, then we ought to be able to make earthquake-proof liquor store shelves.
Or we can make earthquake-proof bottles, or at least the biodegradable bottles, so when they fall, it's not dangerous.
So
and
once the floor starts shaking, an airbag, poof, just pops open. Mm-hmm. Catches all the liquor bottles as they fall off the shelf. I mean, there are so many ways to approach this. I'm an idea man. I don't deal with the details. I'm not really trying to execute this thing. I need a staff. We need funding. But we're going to solve this problem so that never again will an earthquake video include a security camera from a liquor store. Time to end this nonsense.
Yeah, well, and that has huge economic impacts potentially for Kentucky. I mean, can you imagine if all of our bourbon barrels just cracked right down the middle?
All of a sudden just roll out of the warehouse.
That's not good.
I'd pay money for it. I tell you what, I'd like to see that. All right, but there it is. That's enough. I just got tired of looking at all those bottles breaking. Thinking, can't we do anything about this? We can't do a lot of things. We can do something about
it. But it's dramatic. It's good for TV.
Next up, worse than we thought. Kentucky, 7th highest rate of skin cancer in the country. We're talking about melanomas. And this, Shelley, we've talked about this before. This has never, ever made sense to me. The top 10 states for melanoma are number 1, Utah, number 2, Vermont, number 3, Minnesota, number 4, New Hampshire, number 5, Idaho, 6, Delaware, 7, Kentucky, 8 is Nebraska, 9 is Iowa.
Yeah. So none of those southern states.
Those southern states has anything to do with the top rates for melanoma. Melanoma, we assume, is due to ultraviolet radiation from the sun. The rate should get higher as you get near the equator, but instead we find they are higher near the North Pole. We've got up there Vermont. Maine is comes in at number 10. And Montana's number 12. So we are looking at states that are further from the equator having higher rates of melanoma.
Do you think that they just educate better in the South?
Absolutely. You know how the Southern people are about their health. They are way ahead of the Northern people. This is the article. This is Quote Wizard, which was an insurance company, and they speculate. They said, residents of the Southern states protect themselves better than those in the Northern states. And if you believe that, then I've got an earthquake-proof liquor store shelf to sell you, because that is in no way true. Men have a disproportionate rate of cases. Men are 28.4 per 100,000. Women, 17.7. So the men are a good third above the women. So when you talk about tanning booths, and I detest the tanning beds, tanning booths, and so forth, but apparently the men are all over the tanning booths, whereas those Southern women are relatively protected.
Just northern men hit those tanning booths. It's just the men in the north.
Yeah, because after all, where are you going to get a suntan in the north if you don't go in a tanning booth?
This is true.
I don't understand it. I will be honest. But I will tell you, when you start thinking about who gets melanoma, people of African-American descent relatively protected. So when you look at Utah, number one, Vermont, number two, I think there are some ethnic differences in your rates of melanoma. And so I think we are looking at a condition that preferentially affects people with lighter colored skin, particularly people of Irish descent, people with red hair, people with freckles, and so forth. And I'm just thinking that there aren't that many. We go down to Texas is the safest, the lowest rates of melanoma. Their rates are 12.6 per 100,000. Utah, 41.2 per 100,000. I believe Texans in general have darker skin than people from Utah. That is my theory on this. Now, it doesn't work entirely. You can run these numbers, and you can get census data, which I actually did. This has vexed me for so long. But it's not exactly a linear. But I will say the alternative theory that Southerners, that people from Florida and Mississippi are so good at taking care of their skin that the fine folks of Minnesota could learn a few lessons from them, that does not hold water with me any more than a liquor bottle and an earthquake.
Well, now, the data there, is that new cases? Is it?
Yes.
Okay. So
rate of new melanomas ranges from 41 per 100,000 in Utah to 12.6 per 100,000 in Texas. The bottom five states, I'll give you New York, Mississippi, Louisiana, New Mexico, Alaska, and Texas. So construct me a grid. Explain that to me. Makes no sense.
Nope. It does not.
Okay, next up, cancer-sniffing dogs in the news again. This was from the Journal of the American Osteopathic Association. Interesting that they would publish in that journal. Osteopathic physicians are mainly primary care physicians, a lot more heavily in family medicine. They are interested in musculoskeletal medicine, so sports medicine is also. The July issue of the Journal of American Osteopathic Medicine, there are three beagles who can identify lung cancer by scent. And, you know, we've had that one dog in Spain that we talked about that he could apparently smell lung cancer. And it's the same thing. They led the beagles into a room with blood samples at nose level, some from people with cancer, some without. The dogs would sit when they saw a cancer.
Hmm.
So your dog, you got your blood sample right there. It's sample number 17. And the dog sits and you die.
So is the dog trained to do that?
Yeah, the dogs are trained to sit when they smell it. I don't know. I smell a break coming. We need to take a break and come back with our second fractional portion. We'll talk more about beagles and other things. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello, and welcome to the second fractional portion of Health Matters. This is Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the We're Back, and it's worse than we thought. Last time we talked about a little bit about the chemicals, our sponsor, the chemicals that we use to protect ourselves from mosquitoes and ticks. We also talked about the unfortunate situation with wine bottles in an earthquake, and we talked some about melanoma rates and cancer-sniffing dogs. I want to finish up the cancer-sniffing dogs this fractional portion, but first, let's remind you of our sponsor, Insect and Arthropod Repellents. It's a jungle out there. Now, on the skin, these can be used on skin or clothing. First one and the main one you need to know is DEET. This is Off, Cutter, Sawyer, Ultrathon, and other products. DEET, if it's less than 10%, limited protection, only maybe an hour or so. Once the DEET concentration's more than 50%, you don't get additional protection. So we're usually using a 20 to 50% DEET, and we put that on our skin. Again, reapplying as we sweat on a fairly dry day, or if you're not doing a lot, you're sitting around. One application may take care of the mosquitoes, the ticks, and so forth. If you're doing a lot of stuff, you may have to reapply. Picaridin, it's a Cutter Advanced, Skin So Soft, Bug Guard Plus. Those is also a skin product. I will tell you, last summer I had DEET and I had Picaridin, and I tried them on alternate days, and I got more bites on the Picaridin than the DEET. That's not necessarily, I mean, some mosquitoes, and I suppose some groups of mosquitoes, will be more repelled by one of these things than the other. But my limited experience was that the Picaridin didn't quite work as well. Oil of lemon eucalyptus, repel and off botanicals. This is exactly what it says. It is a lemon eucalyptus oil. Not recommended for kids under age 3. I believe that's right on that. The others, not for kids under age 2 months. And then there's something called IR3535. This is Skin So Soft, Bug Guard Plus, Expedition, and Skin Smart. A product I have not had experience with, the IR3535. I found the DEET worked. I found the Picaridin, which I just happened to have, didn't work as well. And that's pretty much where I stopped it. They mention if you're applying sunscreens, put the sunscreen on first and then put the bug repellent over the sunscreen. They do not recommend, the CDC does not recommend, a combination sunscreen bug repellent because, frankly, the protection wanes at different times, and so you may need to apply either too much insect repellent or not enough sunscreen, depending on how much you're sweating. For clothing, permethrin. This is Permanome, Sawyer, Permethrin Repel, Ultrathon Permethrin Clothing Treatment. This is a marvelous product. If you don't know about permethrin, you should. It has already been used for a number of infestations, everything from, scabies to ticks. And it works. It really works well. I run a band of permethrin around the tops of my shoes and socks, the lower parts of my jeans, and then a second band at the waist. And I have been able to do some pretty heavy woods work and not have problems. So,
and you put that on your clothes?
On the clothes, not on the skin. Permethrin is not for skin. Yeah, I mean, they use it for as a fly repellent for horses, as a spray, but that is a very dilute solution. The stuff you get for clothing should be used only on clothing. The neat thing about it, you can apply it at the start of the season, and it will last through several washings. So even if I go out and happen to stumble into the woods and forget to spray, I still have some protection left over from last time I put it on. I think it's a marvelous thing. Clothing treated is effective through 70 launderings. You think about it, 70 launderings will get me through at least a month.
Then
treated for 24 to 40 hours in advance of travel and allowed to dry. But even spraying it on before you do something seems to work decent. I'll put it that way because I have done that as well. Most repellents, this is, information from the CDC. Most repellents can be used on children over age 2 months. If a child is less than 2 months old, as far as skin stuff, you really should just use nets. And the oil of lemon eucalyptus should not be used on children age less than 3 years old. So that is our sponsor once again, insect and arthropod repellents. You need to get some because the ticks and mosquitoes that we have now are not the ones you grew up with, and you need to use them. And we at Health Matters strongly prefer DEET for the skin and permethrin for clothing items and shoes. Now we're back to the cancer-sniffing dogs, Journal of American Osteopathic Association, three beagles, 97% accuracy rate between blood samples from patients with malignant lung cancer and samples from healthy controls. Problem with this is there were limited numbers of samples. The dogs were fresh. They had plenty of time. You bring the beagles into the lab. First of all, you got to feed them, and you got to keep their hair out of the machines and all that kind of stuff. And then secondly, they're going to see a lot of samples coming in at midnight or 2 a.m., and it just doesn't work that way. So the fact that the dogs can smell lung cancer is nice, but what they're trying to do now is figure out what are these dogs smelling. If they can figure out the chemical, the volatile chemical that is in the air that the dogs smell that makes them that accurate, then they can run a test, an assay for that chemical in the blood, and they will be able to use a blood test to detect lung cancer.
And these were, you said, malignant lung cancer, right? So these were advanced, stage 3, stage 4?
They did not necessarily say that. They said okay. It was non-small cell. Small cell is a different type of lung cancer that behaves differently. These were the non-small cell lung cancer. But they did not stage them. They just said okay. They had that. The let's see. Nope, nothing mentioned there. They mentioned, of course, right now the standard for screening for lung cancer. If you are a smoker, age 55 to 74, well, actually to 77, Medicare will cover it. A smoker age 55 to 77 and you have smoked for more than 30 years, which most people age 55 have, then talk to your doctor about getting a CAT scan. Because that CAT scan, that CT scan, is the best screen that we've got right now. These dogs may lead to the development of a blood test. What bothers me, once again, it's worse than we thought. At present, says this press release from the American Osteopathic Association, dogs are better at screening for cancer than the most advanced technology. No, no, no. They have not been tested in a population laboratory situation. We simply train them to smell blood samples. That is way different from the way we screen for cancer. And it bothers me, those type of statements. First of all, we've said all along, I don't think I would trust a dog. Maybe the dog's having a bad day.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah. Maybe it just likes you.
Yeah, or maybe the dog got tired right in front of my blood sample. You thought about that. Maybe the dog just says, I'm going to take a break. You know, no, this is not lung cancer. And all of a sudden, I may be going to surgery because the dog got tired.
Yeah.
And I cannot, that is not acceptable.
Mm-mm. Nope. All right, so. And they haven't done a study with the dogs head-to-head with the CT, right?
So, no, they haven't.
I mean, you can't.
A population study. Like I said, you know, when you're screening, you're going to be screening, well, across the United States, millions of people. We still have millions of smokers, and we're going to be screening them every year. And so that is hard work for anybody in any type of machine. We desperately need better screening. There's no doubt about that. And they did mention they're going to look at breast and colon cancer as well. Is there something in the blood that these dogs can figure out that will teach them to identify these other cancers? I think, you know, when you look at it, you think, well, gee, that's incredible. These dogs are the most technologically advanced cancer screen we've ever had. And you go back and say, no, really, we're still trying to figure out how to screen for cancer. And maybe these dogs are a clue, but maybe they're not. Because let's face it, we've had a cure for cancer pretty much every year since the 1970s, and we still get cancer, and we still die. Mm-hmm. So don't hold your breath. Go ahead, take a deep breath. The beagles will, so you should too. And we'll see if anything comes of this or not. Now, it is time to talk about worse than we thought. We've already been through half of this fractional portion. I'm very disappointed in you, Shelley,
because you just won't
shut up when we are in the middle of this.
Just every rabbit hole I have to explore.
But I wanted to explain to people, you know, in my lifetime, in our lifetime, because Shelley's not that much younger than me.
No.
We have seen the U.S. healthcare system go from arguably the best in the world. There were arguments about that, and I was one of those raising those arguments. Not that I'm any kind of a prophet or anything, but it just when you're working with poor people in Eastern Kentucky, you see the system not working that well. But in many places, the best in the world. To the point now where our healthcare system is widely perceived as broken. possibly beyond fixing. And I wanted to give you three examples of the things that contributed to the deterioration of our healthcare system.
Only three?
Yeah, because that's, like I said, you've been talking the whole segment, and at this point, that's all I've got time to
do. All right, three.
All right.
Three it is.
This was, first one was an editorial, and I'll take 8 points out of this, or I got nine, I guess. Eight. I misnumbered
it. Just pick a number.
8 points from this editorial. This is from a couple of masters in public health people at Emory University. In the Annals of Internal Medicine, this was the March issue, and I saved it. The title is Ominous Reversal of Health Gains in the U.S. Time to Rethink Research Priorities. After decades of gains, the life expectancy in the United States has been declining since 2015. And that decline is being driven by increases in midlife mortality. We're not talking about kids overdosing on drugs. We're talking about midlife mortality rates among whites, Hispanics, Asians, and Pacific Islanders, traditionally people who should usually enjoy a better health than some other ethnic minorities. And these are caused by preventable conditions, overdose, alcohol-related illness, homicide, hypertensive, high blood pressure-related diseases, metabolic disorders like diabetes, some types of cancer, and chronic respiratory illnesses. The pattern, and listen to this statement, the pattern and the nature of this trend point to a potential underlying systemic fault line and call for a rethinking. That is, there is something wrong that this many people are dying of these preventable conditions in our healthcare system. We are focusing on the wrong thing. They mentioned the U.S. ranks among the lowest in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development nations in several health indicators. Life expectancy among older adults in most high-income countries temporarily dropped into 2015, but then burst. It came back up. But we have not reversed that fall. In fact, it has been accelerated. It certainly, and this may be refreshing, it is not because we don't spend enough money. We spend twice, 2.5 times the average spent by the other member nations, yet their people are living longer.
We can't just throw more money at it. I know what, let's focus on quality, because we've been doing that too over that same time period. I mean, seriously, we have.
We've focused on improving quality. Our life expectancy has gone down. We have focused on modern technology, new drugs, biologics, precision medicine with genetic analysis. Life expectancy has gone down. But here's what we have not done, and I think this is blatantly obvious to Kentuckians and I think many of our other listeners from around the world. In social spending, we lag behind almost every other country. Again, we're outspending them all for health care. But you look at social spending. This is education. This is access to basic health care. This is social services. We are behind. It is 19.3% of our GDP, 21% average in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development Nations, and 32% in France. 19% in us and 31.5% in France. And, you know, here in Kentucky, we have decided to cut back on education. We are underfunding our schools. We are underfunding our colleges and universities. We are underfunding our programs for preschool providing services for children.
I was looking at a needs assessment. Sorry, I'm going to rant now. I was looking at a needs assessment yesterday that was conducted for our region. You know what the number one critical need was, the critical thing that came out of the study? Pediatric obesity.
Yep.
So let's underfund that. Let's not educate our kids. Let's not increase nutrition education or exercise or
so. We are digging a hole. We are digging a hole, and our healthcare system is going to somehow have to bail us out of this hole we're digging because we're not educating our kids. We're not providing the services they need to lead a healthy life. And this is the gist of this editorial is we've got to think about our research priorities because we're researching the high tech stuff. Mm-hmm. Where the research right now is being driven by the pharmaceutical industry. Researching new drugs and new cures, and obviously the genetic analysis and precision medicine allows them a Pandora's box here of possible new avenues to research and treat. That's all happening, but nobody is putting an equal amount of research into the gains we could get in our health if we simply educated our young people. Point four, 50% of our healthcare spending, we account for 50% of health research spending. We are still spending a massive amount of money on health research. Point number five, the widespread reversal of life expectancy raises a critical question whether our country has faltered in its selection of research priorities. Shouldn't we be looking at things that would make people live longer rather than being fascinated by basically moonshots genetic precision medicine?
Well, the things that are going to help us live longer, you can't charge for, or we don't have a structure to charge for those things.
Yeah.
You know, so the money there again is driving research priorities that are not helping the situation.
Yeah. And this is where our colleges and universities have simply exited the field. They when you read their press releases, it is all about a new molecule, a new biologic agent, a new technology. It is not about getting out into communities and making people live longer.
Or faster. Yeah, once you have the heart attack, we're going to get to you faster.
And so you ask yourself, you know, what, I mean, our universities, if they share our problems, if their research priorities are our priorities, then where are they? You know, where are the universities in the community where they could actually make a difference? Final point on this editorial, if we are serious about promoting health gains in the U.S., we must examine the current and alternative priorities in our investment in health research. Life expectancy varies starkly by county, with an 8 to 9-fold difference. Persons from the healthiest counties have a life expectancy 20 years higher than those from the poorest. Some of the poorest counties in the U.S. have a life expectancy similar to Niger, the Congo, Afghanistan. And I will tell you, Shelley and I, live and work in the Afghanistan of the United States in terms of life expectancy. The number of people who die at a young age of preventable causes is just horrific. It's happening all around us, and that's why this rant. We need help.
We need a lot of help. And it's very interesting working in academics is how do we prepare future providers to make a difference, a positive difference in a system that is broken and doesn't support the things that we need to do to address pediatric obesity here in Eastern Kentucky.
Well, and all right, so what we do is we take these bright young people who could be leaders in their community, we pull them to a university for 4 years, a medical school, a physician assistant school for anywhere from 2 to 4 years, then perhaps a fellowship for a PA, perhaps certainly a residency, perhaps a fellowship. We're pulling them out of the community for a decade. And then we insert them back into the community and wonder why they're not effective members of their community.
After teaching them all this high-tech stuff.
Right. They are isolated from the people they're supposed to serve by the educational system, and it's just too much for these young people to overcome. And we think, well, they should read books. They should have more liberal arts. They should write poetry or express their thoughts. And I'm thinking, they should have stayed in the community in the first place. You should be able to teach a person in this day and age how to practice medicine without isolating them from the people that they serve, in my opinion.
I agree.
All right, next up. By the way, we're just going to rant the rest of the show. So if rants bother you, I mean, it starts off, I am upset. I don't drink. You know that.
Yeah,
I do not drink alcohol, and yet I am upset seeing all those wine and liquor bottles crashing to the floor. That's where it started. I got mad at that, and I have not been unmad since the earthquake.
We need another earthquake to shake you back into a better
mood. If I could see an earthquake and I could see those liquor bottles being cared for in such a way that they didn't break, then I guess I would think, well, there's some right stuff with the world. I will tell you, I'm working on a show. I may be able to put this together where we talk about some of the things that are right. Human papillomavirus, the HPV vaccine has been terrific at cutting our rates of cervical cancer. Young people are not engaging in drugs and sex the way that they did years before. We've got some good things going on, even in Kentucky, but right now we're not talking about them because I'm still mad.
We're still mad, yeah. We're going to rant.
All right. Next up, I know we got 30 seconds, but I'll just introduce this idea. This was death by a thousand clicks, where electronic health records went wrong. This was published in the magazine Fortune. It is a Kaiser Health and Fortune investigation into the electronic medical record industry. And if you wonder why your healthcare provider won't look at you in the eye anymore and why they seem to be distracted, we will tell you why in our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello, and welcome back to the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. This is Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the We're Back, and it's worse than we thought. And you know, part of that, of course, that it is a description of the show. I'll give you that. You know, it hasn't gone in any way like we dreamed it would. You come back, you think, you know, we've got so much energy stored up. This is going to be a slam dunk show. The difference between slam dunk and slapdash is pretty darn close.
It's so, a very fine line.
Yes, and
very
we went to the slapdash side of it, but that's okay. Our sponsor for the final time, insect and arthropod repellents. It's a jungle out there. I want you to remember two words, one of them not even a word, DEET, which is an acronym describing the active ingredient, N-N-diethyl-M-toluamide or N-N-diethyl-3-methylbenzamide. Either one is DEET. And this is a product that goes on the skin of anybody over age 2 months, but use it sparingly in the young children. It is a insect repellent. It repels mosquitoes. It also repels ticks. And it does a pretty good job of it. You can put it on your clothing. It does tend to stain light-colored clothing, and you can put it on your skin. If you're using a sunblock, you're using too much chemicals. You know, stay out of the sun. My goodness, what you know, just go out for about 20 minutes and then get in the shade. You don't need to do that. Plus, you're going to be wearing a long sleeve shirt. Tuck that shirt into your trousers anyway.
And a hat.
Who needs sunblock?
And a hat. Yeah.
So if you're sensible about this, you can really enjoy being outside. And I am serious about that. If you're not sensible about this, you go out to, say, this time of the year, you're picking blackberries or you're in the woods, you're trimming stuff up, and you get into some high grass, and all of a sudden you are overrun with what they call them turkey mites, which is the nymph form of the Lone Star tick. The Lone Star tick itself is a very aggressive biter. It basically, as soon as it hits your skin, it starts biting. You've got the old common variety dog ticks, which is almost laughable now. Those things kind of, you find them crawling around looking for a place to bite. Now, I'm just thinking, you know, the Lone Star ticks are just eating their lunch, literally eating their lunch. And then there is a new one, as if we didn't have enough ticks, an East Asian tick that is now East Asian longhorn tick. And these things are adult ticks that swarm, and they sound very nasty. Although I think I can pick them off faster than they can swarm on me if I see them coming.
You think?
I have never fought the East Asian longhorn tick.
That might be an interesting demonstration sometime. It's just see who's faster.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like running into a spider web. You know, all of a sudden you get really busy and no one can tell what you're doing.
If somebody's winning, we don't know who. Yeah.
Who could tell? I mean, I've lost to a lot of spider webs. Anyway, that's our sponsor, the insect and arthropod repellents. And again, we believe DEET for skin, permethrin for clothing. These are essential elements of the outdoor person's wardrobe, of their toolbox, in my case. If you're going to be out in the woods, you need to take this seriously, because these are not your fathers and grandfathers and mothers and grandmothers ticks. These are entirely different species and many more diseases and possible ailments that people are afflicted by coming from these ticks. Back to what we talked about. Now we're talking about death by a thousand clicks. This is published in March 18th in the journal and the magazine Fortune, and it is a Kaiser Health and a Fortune investigation. And I'm not gonna. I mean, they of course they have to sell magazines, and so they get into some of the problems with electronic medical records. We've already talked about research priorities gone awry. We have spent most of our research dollars on high-tech interventions for individual diseases and not really supported the health of our people through population spending, through things like education and social programs, because they are not very exciting. No one seems to want to give money for that. They would rather build an institute or something like that. The second problem we've got right now is we have had a decade-long distraction from caring for our patients. 10 years, President Barack Obama signed into law a law to accelerate the digitization of medical records. That is, 10 years ago, I think it was something like 9% of, there it is, in 2008, 9% of hospitals had an electronic health record. The rest of them, folders, papers, handwritten documents, and so forth. And Obama said, it is time, certainly. We look around at our ATMs, we look at the banking industry. This thing should be, once again, we said, a slam dunk. It should be fairly easy to put this into our healthcare system, and then we will be able to share our records. Rather than an electronic ecosystem of information, our thousands of electronic health records largely remain a sprawling, disconnected patchwork. Effort has handcuffed healthcare providers to technology they can't stand, and it has enriched and empowered a $13 billion a year industry that sells it. So the point now that the industry itself has the financial chops to thwart efforts to improve it. We created a monster with this.
Do you think that some of the issues or the frustration, I know you and I have a lot of similar frustration when it comes to the electronic medical record, but do you think the generations coming behind us who grew up with computers and grew up doing everything on laptops and tablets instead of textbooks and pencils and paper, do you think they'll view this differently and be able to interface with it with a lot of less frustration?
I think maybe less frustration because they're used to bad software. This is terrible software. It does not do what it was intended to do. You know, again, you think about the ATMs, for instance. Mm-hmm. Put in your PIN, do your banking, arrange your retirement, anything that you want to do, you can do anywhere in the world, and the transactions come home to you. Now, it has been obviously vulnerable to hackers. But that's really the big problem with it. It works really well. It's much better than carrying around cash or writing checks at the gas station. It's just this is a wonderful thing. This is bad software. And this is what the Fortune article says, unlike the global network of ATMs, the proprietary electronic health record systems made by more than 700 vendors routinely don't talk with one another, meaning doctors still resort to transferring medical data through fax machines. Believe it or not, we have a fax machine in our office that churns all day long with faxes.
Yeah, because the EMRs don't talk to each other.
Right, and it's right next to the Victrola, so that when we get upset, we just crank the crank and we can at least listen to music while those faxes are churning out to our office. The problem, first of all, many problems with the electronic health records, they were made for billing. Mm-hmm. That you check certain boxes and it generates a note, and that note generates a certain bill. And it is absolutely ironclad if I wrote a note, I might forget a word or forget to include some detail, but this thing will not let me close a note till I do. So in that sense, it's a great billing document. It costs then consumers more. Mm-hmm. Rather than saving money, it is designed to maximize billing. And that's what it does. So anytime you're filling out a sheet where you list a bunch of symptoms, that sheet's going to get scanned into the electronic health record, and they can charge a higher bill. Ironically, right. You're doing the work as a patient, as a consumer, you're doing the work that allows your healthcare provider to charge a higher fee.
To bill. And aren't there some legal issues with regard to who owns the data, which affects sharing
right.
between these other
companies. Was interesting. You know, back in the, I think it was pretty clear when I was in medical school that electronic medical, the medical record, the charts and so forth, they were mine. I could sell charts to another physician who came into the community. I'm getting ready to retire or leave. I would sell my charts. I would sell my office. I would sell my clinic to them. And they're not paying for furniture. They're paying for access to the healthcare records of patients. So when I started my practice, my clinic owned the charts. We had the idea, and it sounded really good, that the patients themselves owned their data. That was the idea. That's not true.
Right.
Again, if you own the data, just try collecting it and taking it private. In fact, there's no way you can do it. Mm-hmm. And it looks like, in practice, the electronic health records company own it, because if the hospital or the clinic doesn't pay their monthly fees, then the data disappears. Mm-hmm. So I think that would, to me, define ownership. So at any rate, we've got an industry then that was designed for billing, a health record that now belongs to a company that is not interested in healthcare. It is a software company. Then also these vendors, they impose gag clauses that you can't actually talk about the problems with their product. You're not allowed to. A couple of facts here I've got in big, bold letters. The average ER doctor makes over 4,000 clicks during a single shift.
That's
4,000 decisions made that could be made in different ways. This is John Halamka, who's Chief Information Officer at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He served on a number of these committees. He said, in America, we have 11 minutes to see a patient. You've got to be empathetic, make eye contact, enter 100 pieces of data, and never commit a mistake. It's not possible. That's where we are.
Mm-hmm.
The couple of other things, there is, as you might imagine, reading a computer printout is darn near impossible. Sensitive information buried in an endless scroll of data. These notes have more than doubled in size, average. One study from the researchers at Oregon Health and Science University estimated the average clinician working in an ICU may be exposed to 7,000 passive alerts every day.
Wow.
So how do you decide among the 7,000 alerts you get which one means your patient is in serious problems?
And then you still have to print all that stuff in fax on the old fax machine to get the transmit information.
They will not even transmit that information. I've got to. Mm-hmm. Here's another fact. Average time. Most physicians right now, the average time a doctor spends is an 11.4-hour workday. I mean, the days are mm-hmm. long. We don't do as much overnight shifts as we did. We have people that cover nights. But average 11.4-hour workday, 5.9 hours of that 11.4 hours is on a computer.
Charting.
Mm-hmm. And I myself have personally seen this. By the end of the day, after all that charting, it just eventually you feel like that feeling you got when you took your last final exam in college.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your mind is just numb. I go home and I just can't think. Mm-hmm. I have expended it all. And I worry about what my patients get from me late in the day.
Yeah.
Because I have been fighting this computer for so long, hour after hour. I have changed my schedule because of the electronic health record. I'm trying to give myself time to do it. But even with a schedule, at my point in my career, I don't need a lot of income. My family's already my kids are already left, and so I decided to go with a lower income and try to give myself time, but it is still absolutely exhausting fighting these computers. Final thing, very quickly, we're about to run out of time here. This was an editorial from a repeated editorialist in the New York Times, June 8th. The business of healthcare depends upon exploiting doctors and nurses. Just basically the key points: corporate medicine has milked all the efficiency it can out of the system. One resource that seems endless and free is the professional ethic of medical staff members, doctors and nurses, working on their own time to try to overcome these inefficiencies. I'll make one point. I will get off the air. From 1975 to 2010, the number of healthcare administrators increased by 3,200%. There are now 10 administrators for every doctor. So this is the healthcare system we practice in. This is the reason, in my mind, one of the many, that our life expectancy is falling, and this is why we need to get off the air. Special thanks to our Moorhead State Public Radio producer, Paul Hitchcock, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. Rick would be so proud. If you go to WMKY.org and listen to our shows, or visit us on HM Radio Show on Facebook. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show, and remember, Health Matters is very similar to insect repellents. The search for an insect repeller can be confusing and sometimes scary. Is Health Matters safe? Can I use Health Matters on my children? What are the most common side effects with health matters? These questions and more deserve sound answers before you head out into the wild of Mother Nature.
Not only does Health Matters keep mosquitoes, ticks, biting flies, gnats, and other bugs away, Health Matters are a safe and effective way to prevent insect-borne diseases. Several million people worldwide die from mosquito-borne diseases every year, but mosquitoes and other insects can be controlled.
Now, insects and arachnids that bite in self-defense instead of to feed, such as yellow jackets, bees, wasps, hornets, and certain answer spiders, they cannot be repelled with Health Matters.
Humans attract mosquitoes and other blood-feeding insects by their breath and skin odors. The insect is attracted to the carbon dioxide in a human's breath.
Health Matters contains an ingredient that makes the person unattractive for biting. However, repellents do not kill the insect. Repellents with higher concentrations of active ingredient provide longer-lasting protection.
The CDC states that DEET is safe for children and infants older than 2 months, and the American Academy of Pediatrics suggests that DEET solutions no greater than 30% in concentration be used in children. The CDC has no opinion on Health Matters.
The CDC does not recommend using combination repellent and sunscreen products because the sunscreen will need to be applied more often than the repellent, and excessive use of the repellent may lead to side effects. But Health Matters can be combined with sunscreens.
Permethrin is available as a spray for clothes, insect nets, sleeping bags, shoes, and boots. Permethrin and Health Matters are not intended for direct application to the skin.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.